and good men who deserve better treatment. End of quote. How often it falls out that God moves strangers to comfort his people when they are denied it from those much nearer to them. There is a law of compensation which is conspicuously exemplified in the divine government of human affairs. A balance is strikingly preserved between losses and gains, bitter disappointments and pleasant surprises. If an heartless Pharaoh determines to slay the children of the Hebrews, his own daughter is constrained to care for Moses. If Elijah has to flee from Palestine to escape the fury of Ahab and Jezebel, a widow at Zarephath is willing to share her last meal with him. If the parents of Jesus Christ were poverty-stricken, wise men from the east come with a gift of gold, which made possible their flight and sojourn in Egypt. If a man's foes be those of his own household, friends are raised up for him in the most unexpected quarters. Let us not then dwell unduly upon the former, and let us not fail to be grateful and return thanks for the latter. Chapter 70. His Son's Death. 2 Samuel 18. The triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the hypocrite but for a moment. Job 20, verse 5. Often so, even when measured by human and temporal standards, how much more so in the light of eternity? Alas, that our hearts are so little affected by that unspeakably solemn consideration, a never-ending future, enjoyed under the blissful approbation of God, or endured beneath his frightful curse. What are the smiles and honors of men worth if their sequel be the everlasting frown of the Almighty? The pleasures of sin are but for a season, Hebrews 11:25, whereas the pleasures which are at God's right hand are forevermore, Psalm 16:11. Then what shall it profit a man if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Yet how many, like Esau of old, place more value upon a mess of pottage than the blessings of heaven? How many, like Ahab, will sell themselves to do evil in order for a brief moment of pleasure or fame? The triumphing of the wicked is short. Yes, and so it proved with David's wretched son. Absalom had laid his plans carefully, executed them zealously, and had carried them out without any compunction. 2 Samuel 15, verses 1, 2, and 5. He had taken a mean advantage of his father's indisposition and had stolen the hearts of many of his subjects from him. He aspired to the kingdom and now determined to seize the throne for himself. Chapter 15, verse 10. He had assembled his forces at Jerusalem and had the powerful Ahithophel to counsel him. He had ruthlessly determined that his father's life must be sacrificed to his ambition and had now gone forth at the head of the army to accomplish his death. 2 Samuel 17, verse 24. His triumph seemed to be assured, but unknown and unsuspected by himself, he was going forth to meet his own tragic but fully merited doom. And David numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. 2 Samuel 18, verse 1. As Ahithophel had foreseen, the delay of Absalom had offered David the opportunity to greatly augment his forces. Though considerable numbers had joined the rebel, yet there must have been many scattered throughout Israel who still remained loyal to David. And as the news of the insurrection spread abroad, no doubt hundreds of them took up arms and went forth to assist their fugitive king. That his army had, by this time, been greatly strengthened is clear from the terms of this verse. David now proceeded to muster and marshal his reinforcements so that they might be used to the best advantage. He girded on the sword with some of the animation of early days, and the light of trustful valor once more shone in his eyes. It seems quite clear that by this time David had no fear of what the outcome would be of the coming conflict. He had committed his cause to God and looked forward with confidence to the issue of the impending battle. The striking answer which God had given to his prayer that the counsel of Ahithophel might be turned to foolishness must have greatly strengthened his faith. His language at the close of both the 42nd and 43rd Psalms, composed at this period, witness to his hope in the living God. Yet let it be duly noted that strong faith did not produce either sloth or carelessness. David acted with diligence and wisdom, marshalling his forces, putting them in good order, dividing them to best advantage, and placing them under the command of his most experienced generals. In order to ensure success, our responsibility is to employ all lawful and prudent means. Declining to do so is presumption and not faith. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab, and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and a third part under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. Verse 2. How true it is that there is nothing new under the sun. Military tactics were conducted along the same lines then as they are now. David disposed his forces into a central army, with right and left protecting flanks. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. 2 Samuel 18, verse 2. David was not lacking in courage, and was ready and willing to share any danger with his men. Yet we believe there was something more than bravery evidenced by these words. Was he not anxious to be on the spot when the crisis arrived so that he could protect his wayward son from the fury of his soldiers? Yes, we see here the father's heart as well as the king's nobility. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. His desire was still upon Absalom, judging that his presence might help to shield him, for he was of too soft a heart to disown the feelings of a father, even toward one who had risen up in rebellion against him. Yet it seems to us that there was something of a deeper character which prompted David at this time. He would fain go forth himself because he realized that it was his sin which had brought all this trouble upon the land, and he was far too noble-minded to let the risks of battle find any in the foreground but himself. Let not the hearer forget what we pointed out several times in the preceding chapters, namely, that it is as the humble penitent David is to be viewed throughout this connection. This it is which supplies the key to various details in these incidents. But the people answered, Thou shalt not go forth, for if we flee away, they will not care for us, neither if half of us die, will they care for us? But now thou art worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that thou succor us out of the city. Verse 3. This is indeed beautiful. David had shown his affection for his faithful followers, and now they evidence theirs for him. They would not hear of their beloved king adventuring himself into the place of danger. How highly they esteemed him, and justly so. He was not only possessed of qualities which could well command, but of those which held the hearts of those who knew him best. The deep veneration in which he was held comes out again at a later date when he was hazarding his life in battle with the Philistines. His men swear to him, saying, "Thou shalt go no more out with us to battle, that thou quench not the light of Israel." Chapter 21, verse 17. He was their light, their leader, their inspirer, their joy, the honored and loved one, in favor with God and man. And the king said unto them, "What seemeth you best I will do." And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. Verse 4. Matthew Henry said, "He might be more serviceable to them by tarrying in the city with a reserve of his forces there, whence he might send them recruits. That may be a position of real service, which yet is not a position of danger." The king acquiesced in their reasons and changed his purpose. It is no piece of wisdom to be stiff in our resolutions, but to be willing to hear reason, even from our inferiors, and to be overruled by their advice when it appears to be for our own good. Whether the people's prudence had an eye to it or no, God's providence wisely ordered it that David should not be in the field of battle, for then his tenderness had certainly interposed to save Absalom's life, whom God had determined to destroy. Unquote. Personally, we regard the king's acquiescence as another indication of his chastened heart. There is nothing more humbles and meekens the soul as a spirit of genuine repentance, as nothing more tends to harden and swell with self-importance than the absence of it. He who is blind to his own faults and failings is unprepared to listen to the counsels of others. An unbroken will is self-assertive and impervious to either the feelings or wishes of his fellows. But David was sorrowing over his past sins, and that made him tractable and in a condition to yield to the desire of his men. As he stood at the gate, watching his army go forth to the battle of the wood of Ephraim, victory or defeat would be much the same to him. Whatever the outcome, the cause must be traced back to his own wrongdoing. He must have stood there with a sad remembrance of that other battle in which a devoted servant had fallen as one murdered by his own hand. 2 Samuel 11, verse 24. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Attai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. 2 Samuel 18, verse 5. So great was David's love for his wayward son that even now he sought to deliver him from the stroke of death. He knew that Absalom was an excuseless rebel who sought his life and throne, who had proven himself to be the very incarnation of iniquitous ingratitude. of unfeeling cruelty, of unadulterated wickedness, of satanic ambition. He was guilty of treason of the vilest sort, and his life by every law of justice was entirely forfeited. Yet in spite of all, the heart of David remained steadfast unto him. There is nothing recorded in Holy Writ which exhibits so vividly the depth and power of human affection, nothing which displays so touchingly love for the utterly unworthy. Therefore, is it not designed to turn our thoughts unto a higher and purer love? Yes, see this aged parent, driven from his home, humiliated before his subjects, stricken to the very depths of his heart by the murderous hatred of the son whom he had forgiven and honored, loving this worthless and devil-driven youth with an unchanged devotion that sought to save him from his just and impending doom. Yet wonderful as this was, it provides only a faint shadow of the amazing love of Christ which moved him to set his heart upon his own, even while they were totally depraved, utterly corrupt, dead in trespasses and sins. God commended his love toward us by the death of his Son, Romans 5 verse 8, and it was for the rebellious and the ungodly that he was crucified. Nor can anything ever separate us from that love. No, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. John 13, verse 1. Verily, such love passeth knowledge. So the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. Verse 6. This statement has presented quite a problem to the commentators, some going so far as to irreverently say there was a slip of the historian's pen. As we have seen, both David and Absalom had crossed the Jordan and were now in the land of Gilead. Chapter 17, verses 22 and 26, which was on the eastward side of the river, whereas their territory lay wholly on the west of it. How then, asked the skeptics, could this battle be said to have taken place in the wood of Ephraim? Did the narrator err in his geography? Certainly not. It is the critics who display their ignorance of sacred history. We do not have to go outside of the scriptures in order to discover the solution to this serious difficulty. If we turn back to Judges 12, we discover that an attack was made by Ephraimites upon Jephthah in the land of Gilead, under pretense of a wrong being done them when they were not invited by the latter to take part in his successful invasion of Ammon. Jephthah sought to soothe his angry assailants, but in vain. A battle was fought near the passages of the Jordan, Judges 12, verse 5, and Ephraim met with fearful slaughter, in all 42,000 of their men being put to death. Now, an event so fearful was not likely to pass away without some memorial. And what more natural than to name their grave, the Aseldama of their tribe, by this name, the Wood of Ephraim, in the land of Gilead. For a short while, the battle was furious, but the issue was not long left in doubt, the rebels suffering a heavy defeat. The people of Israel were slain before the servants of David, and there was there a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men, for the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, And the wood devoured more people than the sword devoured. Verses 7 and 8. To quote Matthew Henry once again, "Now they smarted justly for their treason against their lawful prince, their uneasiness under so good a government, and their base ingratitude to so good a governor, and found what it was to take up arms for an usurper who, with his kisses and caresses, had wheedled them into their own ruin. Now where are the rewards, the preferments, the golden days they promised themselves from him? How they see what it is to take counsel against the Lord and his anointed, and to think of breaking his bands asunder." End of quote. Most evident was it on which side the Lord was. All was confusion and destruction in the ranks of the apostate. The anointed eye may discern the hand of God as manifest here, as on a former occasion it has been at Gibeon, as there the hailstones, so here the wood devoured more than the sword. No details are given, so it is useless to conjecture whether it was pits and bogs or the wild beasts that infested those forests. Sufficient that it was God himself who fought against them, conquered them by a much smaller force than their own, and then they're being pursued by his destructive providences when they sought to escape the sword. Nevertheless, such wholesale slaughter of Israel, in view of their surrounding enemies, was a serious calamity for David's kingdom. And meanwhile, what of the arch traitor himself? He is dealt with separately, and that in a manner which still more conspicuously displayed God's hand. He was made a show of openly. "And Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth. And the mule that was under him went away." Verse 9. "Those boughs, like the hands of a giant, gripped him, holding him fast either by his neck or by his luxuriant hair." 2 Samuel 14, verse 26. "His beast continued its progress, leaving him there as though glad to be rid of such a burden. There he was suspended between heaven and earth, to intimate he was fit for neither." Behold the striking providence of this. "Cursed is everyone that hangeth on a tree." Galatians 3 verse 13. There he hung as an object of shame, filled with terror, incapable of delivering himself, unable to either fight or flee. He remained in this direful situation for some considerable time, awaiting with horror his merited doom. Full opportunity was now afforded him to meditate upon his crimes and make his peace with God. But alas, so far as the sacred record informs us, there was no contrition on his part, nothing to intimate that he now felt unfit to either live or die. As God declared of Jezebel, "I gave her space to repent of her fornication, and she repented not." Revelation 2 verse 21. So the life of Absalom was spared a few more hours, but no hint is given us that he confessed his fearful sins to God before being summoned into his holy presence. No, God had no place in his thoughts. As he had lived, so he died, defiant and impenitent. His father's love, tears, and prayers were wasted on him. Absalom's case presents to us one of the darkest pictures of fallen human nature to be met with in the whole of God's Word. A more melancholy and tragic spectacle can scarcely be imagined than Absalom dangling from the boughs of that tree, deserted by his fellows, for they had one and all left him to his fate, abandoned by God now that the cup of his iniquity was filled, a prey to remorse, for though utterly heartless and contemptless, his thoughts now must have been of the gloomiest nature. Quite unable to free himself, he was compelled to wait hour after hour until someone came and put an end to his wretched life. What an unspeakably solemn object lesson is this for the young people of our day. How clearly the fearful end of Absalom demonstrates the Lord's abhorrence of rebellion against parents. God's word tells us that it is the fool who despiseth his father's instruction, Proverbs 15, verse 5, and that whoso curseth his father or his mother, his lamp shall be put out in obscure darkness, Proverbs 20, verse 20, and again, the eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out, and the young eagles shall eat it. Proverbs 30, verse 17. The sands of this hourglass had now almost run out, and a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak." Verse 10. This man had beheld Absalom's tragic plight, but had made no effort to extricate him. Instead, he went and reported it to the general. And Joab said unto the man that told him, "And behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle." And the man said unto Joab, "Though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Attai, say, beware that none touch the young man Absalom." Verses 11 and 12. And here we must stop. Amid so much that is revolting, it is a welcome contrast to behold the obedience of this man to his royal master. Chapter 71. His son's death continued. 2 Samuel 18. In our last, we left Absalom caught in an oak, suspended in the air, unable to free himself. His predicament was indeed a desperate one, for all his followers had forsaken him. What was to be the sequel? David had given express instructions to his generals, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom." 2 Samuel 18, verse 5. In that charge, we see expressed the weakness of a doting father, rather than the uncompromising faithfulness of a monarch. It was not for the interests of his kingdom that such an insurrectionist should be spared, for none could tell how soon he would occasion further trouble. Sentiment ought never to override the requirements of righteousness, yet often it is far from easy to perform the latter when they come into conflict with the yearnings of the former. By yielding to his paternal feelings and giving such counsel to his men, David created a difficulty which should never have been raised. And a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanged in an oak." 2 Samuel 18, verse 10. The commentators differ considerably in their estimations of what is recorded in this verse and those which immediately follow. Some criticize this man for his timidity in refusing to take matters into his own hands and rid the earth of such a wretch. Others go to an opposite extreme and blame him as a sneak for revealing the situation to Joab, knowing that he would have no scruples against killing Absalom. Personally, we consider he did the right thing in taking this middle course. It was not for him, as a private person, to fly in the face of the king's charge and act as public executioner. Nor was it a thing for him to conceal from the general in charge the helpless position in which the archenemy of David was now placed. All of which illustrates what was said at the close of the preceding statements. And Joab said unto the man that told him, And behold, thou sawest him, and why didst thou not smite him there to the ground? And I would have given thee 10 shekels of silver and a girdle. Verse 11. Those words were evidently uttered rashly on the spur of the moment. For when Joab had listened to the man's reply, he did not further upbraid him. Joab failed to realize the quandary in which David's command had placed this man, or perhaps he was constitutionally incapable of appreciating the conscientious scruples which regulated others, which seems the more likely in the light of what follows. What a coarse and mercenary spirit his words betrayed, as though a monetary reward should have been sufficient inducement for anyone to have slain Absalom in cold blood. One cannot expect such a gross materialist to value the finer sensibilities of others. And the man said unto Joab, Though I should receive 1,000 shekels of silver in mine hand, yet would I not put forth mine hand against the king's son. For in our hearing the king charged thee and Abishai and Attai, saying, Beware that none touch the young man Absalom, otherwise I should have brought falsehood against mine own life. For there is no matter hid from the king, and thou thyself wouldst have set thyself against me. Verses 12 and 13. This unnamed man was not to be intimidated by the fierce Joab, but boldly stood his ground and frankly avowed the principles which had regulated his conduct. Though it was not a lawful command which the king had imposed upon his subjects, yet this one respected the authority of his royal master. Moreover, as he shrewdly pointed out, what advantage would he receive from the largest reward if the penalty for his action were the forfeiting of his own life? That was an argument which admitted no answer, acknowledged by Joab's abruptly terminating the conversation under the plea of haste. Then said Joab, I may not tarry thus with thee. And he took 3 darts in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the yoke. Verse 14. Joab will come before us again, God willing, in the chapters that follow. But this seems as good a place as any to offer some remarks upon his character. It has been rightly said by B.W. Newton, among the followers and closest adherents of David, Joab was one. He was early found with David in the cave. Whilst Jonathan tarried in the court of Saul, Joab was sharing the hardships and dangers of David in the wilderness. Throughout all his subsequent dangers, he stood like a lion at his side, and if extent of outward service were regarded, David perhaps had no such servant as he. Yet in order to serve David aright, it was necessary to have respect not to his office merely, but also to appreciate the character of him who bore that office, to love him for his own as well as for his office's sake, and above all, to remember that no real service could be rendered to David except God were reverently regarded and reverently obeyed. Unquote. It is possible for one to serve because of the dignity of his office, one whose excellency as an individual we have no regard for. In such an event, our service, no matter however energetic, will probably have its springs in self-interest, and its course will be marked by self-will and pride. Such indeed was the case with Joab. He was zealous in maintaining the support of David's throne, yet he was ever alive to the maintenance of his own personal interests. He deemed it best that the crown should rest on David's brow, because by so doing, his own fortunes were furthered. No matter how definitely or plaintively David might express his desires, Joab never hesitated when the opportunity arose to outrage the king's feelings or defy his will, if he could thereby gain his own ends without, at the same time, compromising the stability of the throne. In such a course, Joab regarded neither David nor God. No one can read carefully the sacred narrative without perceiving that in the latter years of his reign, David was little more than a nominal king. He seems to have come thoroughly under the power of Joab, the captain of his armies. On the one hand, he was too suspicious to trust him, and on the other, too weak to dismiss him. It is both interesting and instructive to trace out the occasion and cause whereby Joab established such a despotic control over his royal master. Nor is this by any means a complicated task. David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter saying, "Set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die." 2 Samuel 11 verses 14 and 15. By making Joab the partner and secret agent of his guilty plot concerning Uriah, David sold himself into his hands. In that fatal letter, he forfeited his liberty, surrendering it to this unscrupulous accomplice. By temperament, Joab was a daring and energetic man, a bold fighter in lawless times. The faction of Saul's house was so strong that at the beginning of his reign, David could scarcely call the throne his own or choose his servants according to his own pleasure. Joab was an able warrior, and though he sometimes avenged his own private quarrels at the expense of his sovereign's honor, thereby vexing him at heart, yet he was too strongly entrenched to be displaced. Nevertheless, at that time, David was not afraid to open his mouth and rebuke him for his slaying of Abner. Nay, he openly asserted his authority by compelling Joab to rend his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourn before this very Abner. 2 Samuel 3, verses 28 to 31. A most humiliating experience for one of his proud heart, and which made it unmistakably manifest that David was as yet supreme in his own dominions. Circumstances might still constrain David to employ this renowned warrior, and he had not, short as had then been his reign, yielded himself up to this imperious subject. On the contrary, as his own cause waxed stronger and stronger, and the remnant of Saul's party dispersed, he became the king of Israel in fact as well as in name, so that his throne was established not only by law, but by public opinion too. For we are told that whatsoever the king did pleased all the people. 2 Samuel 3, verse 36. Consequently, he was now in the condition to rule for himself, and this he did, for a little later we find him appointing this officer to be the commander of his army by his own decision, and that simply because Joab was the one who won that rank when it was promised by David as the reward to any individual in his host who should be the first to get up to the gutter and smite the Jebusites at the storming of Zion. 2 Samuel 5, verse 8. We have only to read carefully through the 8th and 10th chapters of 2 Samuel, in which are narrated the bold achievements of David at this bright period of his life, his prowess abroad and his strong policy at home, the energy he instilled into the national character, and the respect he commanded for it throughout all the surrounding countries, to perceive that he reigned without restraint and without a rival. But then came his fearful fall, that evil sowing from which he reaped so bitter a harvest. From that point onwards, we may discern how Joab usurped by degrees an authority which he had not before. More and more, he took matters into his own hands, executing or disregarding David's orders as suited his own designs, until finally, we shall see, God willing, he dared to conspire against his very throne and the rightful successor of his line. An incident recorded in 2 Samuel 14 well illustrates what we have pointed out. There we see the hands of David tied, his efforts to free himself from this oppressor, both feeble and ineffectual, and his punishment of Absalom successfully resisted, for it was Joab, through the widow of Tekoa, who clamored for the recall of Absalom from his banishment. The suspicions of the king were aroused, for he asked, "Is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this?" 2 Samuel 14, verse 19. Nevertheless, he yielded to his will. It seems that this move on Joab's part was without any other design than to embarrass the king and force him to do that which could only lower him in the estimation of his subjects. Certainly, he had no love for Absalom, as the sequel clearly shows. During Absalom's rebellion, Joab, as might have been expected, was loyal to the cause of David, for he had no desire to see his government overthrown and one of another order take its place. Joab knew full well what was in the heart of Absalom, and therefore he was prepared to resist him with all his might. He wished to have the present government of Israel continued, and that in David's own person. Yet it was out of no love for David that he now fought against Absalom. This is evident from his open defiance of the express charge which the king had given his generals. Deal gently for my sake with Absalom. But Joab heeded not, for he had lost all respect for David's commands. Nothing could be more deliberate than his infraction of this one, probably the most imperious which had ever been laid upon him. It was not in the fury of the fight that he forgot his commission of mercy, but in cold blood he deliberately went to the place where Absalom was hanging helpless and slew him. Now, if Joab had loved David and regarded him as his friend, he had never recklessly despised the anguish of David's heart and made him cry, "Would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son."
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."